Greetings, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Okay, good. Let's just take one more minute to settle in. As we say, now that our body is on the cushion, let's bring our mind to our body. This is also a time to, if we're beginning a meditation practice, to allow our body to find its own natural kind of uprightness and ease, external uprightness and internal ease. It's a very particular kind of alert resting. Now that we have 108 people in the room, let's begin by, as we always do, bringing to mind all those extraordinary men and women over many centuries who have brought these teachings of Mahamudra to life in their own life. And in doing so, have not only just enjoyed the fruits themselves, but have been willing to, at great hardship, to pass it on to their students and their students to their students, all the way down to us, so that we can enjoy them in a way that is utterly authentic and completely fresh. And bring to mind just how fortunate we are that the Dharma, this Dharma, is alive. We have an opportunity to take it on, to try it out in our lives. And that we can do so in the company of friends. Sangha is everything along the path. How fortunate we are. And then finally, just to bring to mind the truth that everybody is just like us. Everybody wants nothing but to be happy and at ease. And well, having that intention, everyone just like us seems to make a mess out of it over and over again. So may we wake up so that we can somehow benefit in some way those beings like us who want nothing other than to be happy. Okay. So, just for fun, who is new here? If you're new, just raise your hand. Couple, next. And then everybody else is not on camera. Okay. So just to bring you up to speed with what we do with these heart-to-heart sessions. So these are an opportunity for us to talk about whatever is on our mind, whatever is in the course, in this case, Mahamudra, share our experiences with the course or with our practice or whatever. And I start these by doing my best to confuse and bore you for 15 or 20 minutes. And then we spend the last part of the session trying to clarify. So who knows exactly where everybody is in the course? It's the nature of things, and it's the nature of our online Vajrayana platform that you can go at your own speed and take what you want when you want. But the way it looks like right now is we're at the end of the fourth, roughly we're at the end of the fourth section of our Ganges Mahamudra essence course. And what I'm going to do is just make some comments. As I went through the material, I'm going to make some comments and then I'm going to add a little piece. So for some of you, this material is fairly new. For some of you, you've been practicing Mahamudra or studying Mahamudra for a long time. The beauty is that every time we come back to it, somehow it's fresh because we're different. Our mind is different. Our understanding is different. The language used is different. The voice is different. The commentator is different. Mahamudra is endlessly compelling because it compels the truth of everything, of existence, of our existence, of the nature of perception, of our response to what we perceive. So when we're talking about Mahamudra, we're getting right down to the very essential point. And as you know, there are a number of ways of presenting Mahamudra. There is the Sutra Mahamudra approach, where we spend many, many years, or could spend many, many years, studying the logic and the reason of the various arguments for why reality is this way or that way, or why mind is this way or that way. This is called the Sutrayana approach. And then in the Mantrayana approach, we work with the principles of development and completion and begin to imagine a world, a refined world, a sublime world of the deity, and identify with that. And then there's this approach, what we could call the essence approach. This is the approach that Mingyur Rinpoche is using here, where we go right to the main point, right to the nature of things, the nature of ourselves, the nature of mind directly. This is the power and the beauty and the immediacy of this particular approach. This is the approach that Mingyur Rinpoche takes here and in general, and this is the approach his father, Togujin Rinpoche, always took. So it's critical to understand, you know, in some ways, it feels like there's so much that we have to learn. It could seem a little overwhelming and a little complicated, maybe a little esoteric. But if we remember this one thing, that all of the teachings, all of our study, all of our practice, all of our methods, all of the rituals, all everything is towards one aim. It's toward the aim of loosening grasping. It's all about loosening grasping. If we can understand this, then our entire practice and study life sort of comes together. It becomes quite clear. It's all about loosening grasping. When we apprehend the various sights and sounds, and including our thoughts and emotions, all the various display of mind, when we apprehend it, we don't just enjoy it as a display of the coming together of causes and conditions. We go out and grab it. We grab it and try to pull it towards us if we want it, or push it away if we don't, or ignore it. This is the beginning of the three root kleshas of grasping, aggression, and ignorance. And then all hell breaks loose after that. We become more and more entangled out there and more disconnected from what is here. Our basic, abiding, unchanging wisdom nature, ground Mahamudra. We become disconnected for that. We actually lose contact with it altogether. And so the entirety of the path is nothing else than to come back to who we already are, not to improve who we are, but simply to come back and recognize it. This is the job of what we could call coming home. And in order to do that, we have to loosen and loosen our this impulse to manipulate our world, to close down around our world. We need to loosen that impulse to fixate and grasp, to grasp and fixate. This is everything. This is the main thing. This is the beginning, middle, and end of the path. As I've quoted before, I think the singular guiding quote, if we can only remember a couple of lines, the lines of Tilopita Naropa, where he said, "Son, Appearances don't cause suffering. Attachment causes suffering. Oh, Naropa, abandon attachment. This is the practice. This is not complex. Many things can help us do that. Many things can help us abandon attachment. Our shamatha, our calm abiding meditation, creates an environment that is relaxed, open, and flexible, more spacious. This is the byproduct of shamatha meditation. Our vipassana meditation of insight and inquiry, again, using logic and reason, naturally begins to loosen that grasping when we realize that there's nothing inherently there to grasp at, nor is there a grasper. In the Mahayana, the practice of compassion is like a kind of a secret sauce that warms us and moisturizes our mind and heart. And in doing so, we open and relax. In the Vajrayana tradition, this is the place of devotion that has the exact devotion and compassion are identical. The dynamics are identical. Opening, warming, softening, opening, releasing, grasping. And in everyday life, moments of great beauty open us. When there's a sudden shock, this opens us. This sudden shock dynamic is employed often in the technique of pointing out, as many of you know about. Everything comes to the release of grasping. From the very first time we sat down on the cushion till we got pointing out instructions, the whole path is just loosening grasping. So if you ever are wandering around the streets or in your day and you're going, oh, what is wrong? What is it? I just feel so uncomfortable. Find a way, however it might be. Loosen, relax, open. Maybe you have to go out and look out in the sky. Maybe that would be helpful. Maybe walking around the block would be helpful. Loosening grasping. This is the practice. In our tradition, we have extensive traditions of study and analysis, as you know about. We have extensive traditions of using imagination, which is mantra or tantra. We have extensive traditions of working with the prana, nadi, and bindu, the wind channels and essences, the subtle body, to loosen, and then meditation technique directly to loosen. Everything comes to this. And everyone will find their own particular piece of it, their own particular way in that seems most effective or most accessible. So then, to bring us all up to speed, some of you again know this material well. Some of it is fairly new for you. So I'm just going to say, put a little structure on this just so that we can put a pin in it. So as you've read or probably have read, there's two sort of general preparations for Mahamudra. The first is what's called the common preliminaries. And the common preliminaries, common doesn't mean they're lesser. It means that they're shared by all traditions. Is that we engender the mind that understands how precious this life is. The fact that everything is impermanent. The fact that everything that we do has a consequence, which is karma. And that the suggestion that until we come home and to recognize this unchanging, abiding nature, there is always going to be some dis-ease, dissatisfaction, disconnection, all the disses. This is the common foundational practices, or what we refer to as the four thoughts that turn the mind. This is everything. Mingyur Rinpoche's oldest brother, Chökyam Rinpoche, once said, in relating to these four thoughts, he said, with these four thoughts are on your mind, and when they're blended with your mind stream, everything results as Dharma. And when they're not, nothing does. Then some of us can go on to what we call the four unique foundational practices or Nundro. Some of us have time to do that. Nundro is a long, demanding, complex, very, very profound practice. So if it's something that works in people's lifestyle, that's great. If it doesn't, it's okay. If it doesn't now, but will later, that's okay. Or if we can do it in such a way, for instance, that we can only do some of it, but in doing it, we familiarize with it, ourselves with it. That is wonderful. So as you know, there are four sections, sometimes referred to as five, but they're first that we take refuge. In taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we change our orientation. We find an authentic orientation in this life that in turn changes our karma. So we do this and accompany that with prostrations. This is the first. Then having done that, we warm up. Having done that, we purify this ground through the practice of Vajrasattva mantra, using the imagined deity of Vajrasattva to purify all of our past karma and obscured ways of being. And then having a kind of pure ground, then we enrich that soil through the practice, the ritual practice of giving, which is mandala offering. And then finally, when the soil of our being is and our mind is completely open and rich and ripe, then we unify ourselves with the wisdom lineage, and this is Guru Yoga. So most people know all of that. So I wanted to make just a quick comment for about 5 minutes on another part that Mingyur Rinpoche has been teaching, but I don't think he has taught in this course yet, and I'm not sure that he will. But it's so interesting and so simple and so clear that I thought I would just go through it really quickly. So Mingyur Rinpoche talks about four causes and conditions for Mahamudra. The first of these are sort of underneath the previous or around the previous or generally just kind of in our being that sets us up for a fruitful practice, basically. That first of all, that we have the intention. We have a strong intention to work with the principles. In particularly, he mentions the core principles of the willingness to let go of habitual, unhelpful, unwholesome activities of body, speech, and mind. This is what we call renunciation. And then to engender loving kindness and compassion. These are the this is the what we do with our intention. And then the second is that we embark on the journey with a vast vision. This is everything. When our vision is vast, our activity is vast. When the vision is vast and inspiring to us and wholesome, it naturally brings out our energy and our enthusiasm, and we're willing to do anything. So, for instance, as I've said many times in my town, everybody that we are a big training grounds for ski jumping for the Olympics. It's kind of an absurd thing to do. It goes nowhere. Nobody makes any money doing it. Only three people every 4 years actually get a medal. I mean, it's patently crazy. But the people who do it, the young people who do it, are so enthusiastic. They train morning, noon, and night. They're like completely on fire. So when we have a clear vision that's coherent, that's wholesome, that's profound, then it's like having wind under our sails. Everything goes easily. So if, for instance, we're unclear, if we're getting sort of tired of our practice, tired of our study, tired of the whole damn thing, we need to go back to our vision. What is our vision? What is our vision in life? What gets us up in the morning? And be clear about that. And to the degree that we're clear, all the energy and enthusiasm will come along. The third is that we have a teacher. and that we're relating to a teacher. So here we talk about the four kinds of guru. We could talk about the teacher in person. So this is the story of Naropa and Talopa, the power and the beauty and the transformative quality of the receptivity that that kind of relationship engenders. Then, as you know, there's the guru of what has been written down. There's the guru of our life, of the phenomenal world that is talking to us all the time, if we're willing to listen. And finally, the ultimate guru of our own nature of mind. And finally, the willingness to let go, to enter the path and let go of all of our plans and schemes and expectations and fear, and just take it on. Just try it on. Try on this thing called meditation for longer than seems reasonable. Try on this thing called study, even when it seems a little confusing or maybe boring. Try on this thing called right conduct, about how we are when we talk and what we do. Just try this on, and letting go of our immediate expectations of what's going to happen. Then we become really potent, really receptive students. So these four conditions I have always found to be particularly helpful in engaging any aspect of the path from the beginning all the way to the end. So I thought it was worth mentioning. So let's open it up. Comments, questions about this or anything? Ray?
Ray. Yes, I'm back. Thanks a lot for your love and compassion in putting these in words, these important things. I have another technical questions. We of course come from different directions. I am, and in front of a new teacher having to go through the nandro again. I know that usually we're asked to redo these nandro with the other tradition. If we come, let's say, from the Nyingma tradition and come into the Kagyu tradition, we're asked to do again these nandro. Well, I'm aging. At 65, I don't think I could redo the 250,000 prostration I've done to the 35 Buddha to anybody else, because physically I couldn't do it. And I feel a little challenged by that. How do we proceed? What is the idea?
You don't need to do it again.
I don't need to do it again, because it's been fantastic practice for me.
Well, then do it again.
Even to hurt my body.
So the beauty of being a Buddhist practitioner is that nobody is watching. No one's keeping score. That's either good
news. I don't want to lie.
But Nundro is Nundro. We are the ones who carry the qualities and the wisdom and the freedom of having done Nundro. So if you're inspired to do another Nundro, great, but you don't need to. Mingyur Rinpoche, he has always said that whichever Nundro you do is great.
I know that Rinpoche teaches the traditional way of prostrating, for example. Could we redo another prostration Nundro, for example, in another way that is less, as we say, full prostration? Could we just do a Nundro prostration like this?
The guidance about that is this, that in anything we do to transform, particularly in the Vajrayana tradition, we're working with body, speech, and mind. We're transforming the three altogether. And so if you can do full prostrations and you don't, then you're letting yourself down. If you can do another Nundro and do tabletop prostrations or some amended because you're physically not able to do anything, and if you don't do that, then you're letting yourself down. So do something if you can. Do something if you can. No one ever taught a Dharma practice to harm people. So if you can do some kind of physical concomitant as we get older, or if you have back problems or other physical problems, then that would be wonderful. And so only you're the judge, if that makes sense. But in all honesty, if we're healthy and strong enough, it's, however absurd it sounds, it's encouraged that we do prostrations. Mm. If you're healthy.
Yeah, sure.
Sound body and mind.
You said something.
Even wanting to do Nundro suggests that you're not of sound body or mind. But anyway.
You said something. I want to come back on it. You said something about shock situation. Mm-hmm. That my experience Let's name one. When I heard in June that my precious Rinpoche was moving his seminar to Vietnam, I was shocked for a moment. Let's say that for the moment I received the news, I was in my morning practice with my boyfriend, and suddenly, phew, there was a blank. There was nothing happening. I don't feel that it is. Actually, I was there because I was aware of that experience for sure. But at that moment, I mean, it's like being told suddenly you're going to die tomorrow and you're not prepared for that. There's a blank. Everything becomes white or black, depending on the people that want to name it. And there's a blackout. There's nothing happening. It's a big nothing that happens. How do we cope with these shocking
Oh,
situation?
so at some other point we can talk more deeply, but that is called that blankness. Generally, this is there's a Tibetan word for this as well, hetewa, and it's kind of a blank dullness. And that has to be recognized, as you're saying, that oh, this is awareness itself. This is the background of everything. This is the easel upon which life is plays out. When we recognize that, then there we are. So also sometimes Mingyur Rinpoche refers to this as horizontal liberation. In other words, it's just a gap. But more specifically, what you're talking about, this kind of gap that's dull, that has to be recognized. That's called hetewa.
But it feels like suddenly being like little things on which you put, a big cup and everything becomes black. There's no possibility to go anywhere else but right there.
Yeah, it
And
doesn't really matter because that goes away quickly anyway.
okay. Yeah,
So it
well.
goes away quickly anyway. So it's not good or bad, but it's an unusual opportunity to recognize within that open space. Yeah, but
Yeah,
it goes.
not great.
Yeah, good.
That makes sense. I was telling to Sylvain, he said, well, with all the problems we have actually between Canada and India, what could happen? And he said, oh, maybe we could have a bomb in the plane when we come back. And I said, well, that would be a very interesting experience, actually. You can imagine that you're still aware until the moment it does bang. It's terrifying, but you're aware that you're terrified. And we laughed at that, and the
So
rest of
fear
our meditation
also
was very
fears and
calm.
yeah. Nice. Thanks, Ray. Maria?
Hello, Tim. I have been reading the book Tilopa's Wisdom. It's so precious. And I just on page 108, it says, only the realization of Mahamudra can lead to liberation. This means that any virtuous action that we perform should be embraced by this view of Mahamudra. Now it's the sentence that I want you to say something about. If we practice the creation stage of tantric meditation and join the practice with Mahamudra, it will become the cause for our liberation.
And
That's it. I mean, I cannot get to the truly the relationship between practicing the creating stage and joining the practice of Mahamudra together, because since I joined the Path of Liberation 3 and 4, and I have been practicing as well as Mahamudra, I just left aside the tantric practice of creation and generation stage.
so creation and generation stage, what we're doing is we're using our imagination to imagine our gross body in a more sublime way, to imagine our gross thoughts in a more sublime way as mantra, and imagine our gross thoughts as wisdom themselves. It's an imagination process, practice. And when it says to join it with Mahamudra, it means whenever we can, to allow all of that to come out as an expression, come up, and we hold all of that within awareness. That's what it means to join it with Mahamudra. So sometimes we can allow it to come out as an expression of mind. At other times it comes out as a very kind of mechanical thing. And then we just rest in awareness from time to time. And that's how we join it with Mahamudra. But it's really the same instructions whenever we can, whatever we're doing, to bring a quality of awareness to the, to be present. That's what it means by joining with Mahamudra.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah. It helped.
Yeah, great. Elaine.
Yes, within the context of the path of liberation, I'm doing one and two. And I understood that the nectar of the path was an alternative to the nundra,
yes.
Because I can't do the prostrations,
yes,
physically. It's just
you can do
hard.
Nectar of the path as the basis of the homework, yes.
So that counts as equal to the prostrations? I mean, does that allow you to progress after that?
Well, you progress. It may be that in the future, it's unclear if this will ever come to pass, but it may be in the future that Mingyur Rinpoche will go on and teach certain practices for which one will have had to have nundro. But so far, that's not the case. And you can go on to level 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, where you begin to practice Tara on the basis of nectar of the path.
Okay. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Lilia.
Hi. Hi, everybody. In response to what Ray was saying, I just wanted to say that I couldn't do full prostrations because of physical illness, but I was told to do half prostrations and to do more. So instead of 100,000 half prostrations, I did 150,000 half prostrations.
And we won't ask you who told you to do more.
yes, this was Kagyu. Definitely, it was Dharmadachu.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think what really counted was my intention and attention. I mean, whatever I was doing with my body, I was doing as much as I could, but to stay present while I was doing that and actually do frustrations with the full attention to what that means and the visualization of the refuge tree, you know, that was the practice for me. And it didn't seem to matter. I don't think it was less or more. It was just as long as I was doing the best I could. And the other thing.
Lilia, I think that's the point, that you do as well as you can. I think that's the point everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to say was that, to my joy, Mingyur Rinpoche accepted the practices that I'd done. I did not have to do them again in order to do what he is teaching. And that, I think, is a little unusual, because there were most of the teachers whose full mandalas I had participated in on some level would like you to do their forms of nundra all over again if you do their path of practice. So I'm very grateful for Mingyur Rinpoche's openness about that. It was, I probably should do prostrations again. But
yeah, I'll tell you a quick, really funny, kind of maybe funny story about this. When I was living in Nepal and studying with Tolkuchin, there was a particular text that I really, really wanted him to teach, and he didn't normally teach on the text. And I was really into it. I have no idea, but I was really into it. And I said, "Oh, Rinpoche, if you'll teach me that text, I'll do another nundro." And he kind of looked at me like I was crazy. And he sort of he gave me this quizzical look and he said, "Okay." So I did the nundro. I can't even remember the name of the text that I was so desperate to get. But it's up to us. It's completely up to us. You know, what we want to do, if we want to do more, if we want to do this nundro or not. So I am saying that under the umbrella of Mingyur Rinpoche. So you're right. I think other teachers have different ways of going about this, but under Mingyur Rinpoche's world, he's delighted with anybody who's done any nundro. He respects them all. Yeah.
Yeah.
As did Tokujin. Yeah.
Thanks.
What else, Lily? Anything else? Was that it?
Yeah. That's it. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Good. Isaac?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about undertaking nundra, and like intuitively, it's very exciting, but it's also kind of scary due to time commitment. But I think it is a little bit related to me on some level seeing it as something to get over with rather than doing. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on that.
Well, I've done a fair amount of Nundro, and I don't think I'm finished yet with Nundro. I have aspiration to do some more, maybe. But I have a very weird approach to this, because in the community that Lilia and I grew up in, we were Nundro combatants. I mean, it was like hardcore. And nobody talked about, savoring it, or, you know, going deep in the meaning of it, or it was like none of that. I mean, it was like ninja Nundro. And that was the way I did my first Nundro. And I have deep conviction that Nundro is such a powerful practice that you can't do it wrong, that it will correct all of our weird ambition, all of our weird speed, our aggression. So when I hear the people say, oh, I've done Nundro, I've been Nundro, it's so wonderful. And I think, oh my goodness, something has gone off the rails here. Nundro is a purification practice. So by definition, when we're purifying, really all we see functionally is dirt. That's the sign that it's working. So the dirt comes in the form of resistance, being bored, being irritated, losing faith, just being frustrated, giving up, going off and doing other frivolous things instead. This is purification. And so I think that's why Nundro is so powerful. Almost all practices in the Buddhist tradition have the effect of pacifying mind. Nundro has the effect of purifying karma. This is why it is so highly revered. Yeah. So I don't know if I answered your question, Isaac.
No, I think you did. You did very well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Nundro is not the problem. Nundro is really tough practice. Yeah, Brian.
First, I probably should disclose that I spent a career in teacher education, which provides a backdrop. So my question is, the role of teaching and learning only for the relative world? I'm having a hard time reconciling teaching such as calling to force to live in the moment, to just be uncontrived ordinariness, be open to infinite possibilities. All seems to be calls to not rely on pre-existing knowledge. So where does knowledge fit into enlightenment in an absolute world? It's hard to avoid nihilism if knowledge is perceived as grasping to pre-existing ideas.
Well, knowledge, this is what we call prajna, just seeing the world clearly, the 2 + 2 = 4. And this is just the ordinary knowledge of the world. This is incredibly revered, of course. There's no question about it. But so what we do as Dharma students, and what we're doing along the path, is working to purify old conditioning, old neurotic conditioning that is not in accord with the way the external world is, relatively or absolutely. We don't see relative reality properly. So we train to see relative reality properly. We see someone on the screen of a TV and we think, oh, they really are, you know, really are truly existing bad, wrong, on and on and on. So that's not true. That's our imputation. So that's what we're working with, is we're working to purify our imputation. When we no longer project upon phenomena our funky, conditioned, habitual way of seeing things, then things arise in their own nature. That's called emptiness. And things arise just naturally, cause and effect, circumstance, dependent arisings. And that's knowledge, just how things are, just very simply. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get our biases away from that. That's practice, so that we can acknowledge the relative and the absolute together. Both dance together. There's never one without the other. The relative is always the expression of the absolute, and within the absolute always expresses itself as some kind of display. This was immortalized in the lines of the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. So this honors what we call the two truths, the relative and the absolute. And we work with both. Does that help at all?
Yes, I think I'm probably overthinking things.
Imagine that. But keep overthinking it. And it will then it will become more clear, and then you'll have some confidence. So this is good. Overthinking is what we call contemplation. So it's a good thing to do. But I would say that from my take on our tradition is that relative truth, in some ways we leave relative truth to people who know more about relative truth, just the functioning of, you know, plumbing and things like that. But it's no different. It's no more or less precious than its underlying nature, which is absolute truth. Yeah. Okay. Lou or Doe?
Thank you. It's me. I want to check something out with you, Tim. You've said this a lot, and I know it's in a lot of things. We have this, every sound is Tara's mantra, right? When we're doing the mantra, we're doing the sadhana. The other day I was walking in my neighborhood as I do the sadhana, and I'm hearing birdsong. I cannot turn this into words. So I decided that what this is that's the birds saying the mantra.
So what?
You know, how do we think that every sound is mantra? I can't, like, what about the cars when they make their sound? Is that the way that phenomenal world says Tara's mantra? Can I
mantra here, when we talk about pure sight, sound, and awareness, this is what we call the three purities. Mm-hmm. It simply means that everything arises as empty sound. That's what everything arises as, the mantra of Tara.
Oh, they're empty, not sound. To the words.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question. Harriet. You're muted, Harriet.
Thank you. Yeah. You were talking about joining Mo Mudra with the deity practice. And in my case,
with joining Mo Mudra with what?
With the deity practice, which in my case is just Vajradhara, because that in the guru, yoga. When I'm aware of what I'm doing, when I'm doing the practice, it seems to me that there's a loss of sincerity because I'm there watching what I'm doing.
There's a loss of sincerity?
Yes, because, yes. Because I'm standing aside, I'm not in it.
But you're doing prostrations?
No, I'm doing the guru yoga. So it's Vajradhara that I'm imagining at that moment. But it applies to all the practice, doesn't it? That we should join our Mau Mudra with whatever we're doing, doesn't it?
Yes, but what did you mean by loss of sincerity?
Because my awareness is looking at me in inverted commas, doing whatever, or saying whatever, or reciting whatever. And there is actually there's a there is a line in the prayer to the lineage where we say, may my practice be, the word is not sincere, but there's a name like, word like synonym of that somewhere. So it's probably must be an issue for some people that we're not.
So do you remember the particular word in the liturgy by chance?
I can find it within, you talk to somebody else, I'll go and find it.
So Harriet, so I think this is just an encouragement. May I be, you know, like, may I be wholehearted about what I'm doing?
Yeah, well, that's okay. That's a good word. Okay.
And so that's beautiful.
So what I'm saying is that if I'm being aware of what I'm doing, then the wholeheartedness is not there because part of me is here.
Yeah. I think the important thing, yeah. If you bring wholeheartedness to it, everything else takes care of itself. The practice is so powerful, it will take care of that imagined separation between you and the practice. If you just keep going as you know, you'll become so exhausted. Well, I'm thinking about prostrations again, but even with the Guru Yoga, you just become sort of like, just sort of exhausted. All of that talking to yourself, checking, is this wholehearted? Is this sincere? Am I present? Am I aware? All of that begins to just burn itself out. Just let all of that go. Even the most sublime reminders to be aware and all of that. Just let it go and just do the method. The method takes care of itself. Then we get distracted. We do the method. We feel very sincere and then we don't feel sincere. This is the practice.
Okay.
It's just the practice is a method, and it will take us through all sorts of places of resistance and boredom and irritation. That's the practice. That's what's being purified. So it's wonderful that we all want to do it right, but we can't do it right. And the point is just to do it. Does that make sense? And the results come.
Yeah,
without
yeah.
a doubt, the results come. But we never... I would suggest that we don't see the results of Nundro while we're doing Nundro. We're too much in the swim of it. And we'll begin to feel that the experience of Nundro much later. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. Christy.
Thank you. I was just about to lower my hand, I'm losing my nerve. Thank you for taking my question. How do you do a half prostration? I am so very confused about just even the very basics of walking into my meditation room and do I put my hands up here, here, and here? Do I put my hands up here, here, and here? Let me just explain what I've learned. Taking refuge in the teacher, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But then I read turning confusion into clarity, and somehow that's not right. No mention is made of the teachers, and it's just, it sounds like it's at the crown of the forehead, and then Dharma is at the throat, and then Sangha is at the heart. So could you clarify the basic gestures?
That's right. What you just said. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha.
And Sangha.
That's what you just said, yeah.
Okay.
Simple.
But all right. But that's, what is a half prostration?
So a half prostration means that instead of starting on your feet, standing up, you start on your knees so that you're only going down as half as far. And it's just less.
Okay.
It's just less rough on your body.
Yeah. Well, some of us, their knees and getting down there and up. Yeah. Okay. All right. So does that. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, does that mean that you stand up and then go down every time?
No,
you just stay on your knees.
That's right. That's right.
I'm glad I'm doing Nectar of the Path, but
so you do whatever you can. We used to imagine putting our harness on and attaching it by bungee cords to the ceiling. So all we would have to do is just fall forward, and then it would yank us back. And we always wondered if that would suffice for a prostration. Probably not.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. Anne Louise?
So I really appreciate all this discussion on prostrations, because a year ago, when I was in a retreat with Mingyur Rinpoche, I decided that I couldn't do Nundro because I'm too old and it would take too long, and so I'm doing Nectar of the Path. But I've been living a life of, and I need to clear the karma. And I'm thinking, you know, this, maybe I made the wrong decision. And I heard that you should probably, I heard from, I think it was Mingyur Rinpoche who suggested that you finish Nectar of the Path before you go back to Nundro. Well, then I'm really going to be old. I'm just, but you know, your explanation, I'm so grateful for, of, you know, it being a purifying karma, clearing karma. It's so interesting, and I have a completely different view of it than I had before.
You know, Eloise, what you could also do that would be really wonderful to do for those of us who maybe aspire to do Nundro and it's just not going to happen in this life. Go through, and instead of aspiring to do 100,000, do 100. So that you that then you feel like, oh, I know what that is. You know what they say. You know what the thing is. And that you have a karmic connection to it. That would be wonderful, to do 100, to do 3 of each one each day, just anything. And then you develop a karmic connection to it. Needless to say, that would be really, really wonderful for all of us. Yeah.
So would you still recommend that? I think I heard the recommendation, complete Nundro, complete path of liberation before starting Nundro.
Well, I mean, that's just, what is it, 50 hours per?
Yeah,
it doesn't matter. If you can, he's talking about completing Nectar of the Path before you embark on a full Nundro. But if you just take, you know, if you just take Nundro in this bite size, you can do it at any time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yes, yes. Jemmy.
Hi, yeah. I'm thinking about the quote of abandoning an attachment. And I wonder about abandoning situations where you can get attached, because I do better isolated and not involved in things. I can let go of attachment, but when I am more courageous and get into situations, I get very attached. And so I'm like struggling with, you know, which way to go. Do you challenge yourself more and end up feeling like you're messed up more of the time, or do you stay more careful and feel like you're able to let go of attachment? Do you know what I mean?
And how do you stay more careful and feel like you let go of attachment? You mean by withdrawing?
Not withdrawing. Like in my life, I'm retired, and I have options to kind of practice more and keep to myself and not get involved in things. And I think, oh, that's really good. Yeah, so that's how I can be less attached, is by lifestyle choices. And
yeah, but you know, actually, you're just removed. You're not less attached.
Yeah, but it feels like when I challenge myself, I really get lost.
Yeah, of course. So
I hate that. This
is why in the early tradition, there was a great emphasis on taking monastic vows. That created a kind of cloak of safety, that just the mindfulness of having the vows. And, you know, again, you know, in the Thai tradition, for instance, when they go out in their alms walk or whatever in the morning, they don't even look at the donor. So that is one way to do it. But attachment isn't caused by external situations. Attachment is caused by our graspy mind. So this is the hallmark of the Mahayana. But, you know, in your case, only you know. I mean, the householder life where we have friends and work and engagements is considered to be the hard path, but the fast path. And so the guidance that I got was to do what you do, because we have to have a place to play out our bodhisattva activity and a place to be reminded of our weak points, et cetera, et cetera. This is wonderful, but it's really wonderful also if from time to time you can go in, close the door for 24 hours or 48 hours or 3 days and do retreat. And then that way we remember what is my North Star? What is my guide? You know, we remember in an embodied way, this is what it means to come home. Now I'm home. When we know where home is, then we don't get lost when we go out in the world. Worldly activity becomes confusing and unhelpful when we don't know where our home is. But if we're clear about where our home is, then worldly activity becomes a playground to play out our bodhisattva aspirations. So do some retreat from time to time if you haven't already. It's magic. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that in the sense of like, you can't be, I mean, the path is about mistakes, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's what I hate.
Yes. But what the reason we get lost when we're out in the world is because we haven't found our home. This is why we practice. And when that is clear, one day I was talking with Sogner Rinpoche. He was in my bedroom actually at our home. And I said, and I was traveling a lot and frustrated. And I said, Rinpoche, like, how do you like maintain this travel schedule of yours? This is crazy. And he said, now I said, you're always away from home. And he touched his heart and he said, my home is always with me here, my inner home. Yeah, beautiful. Okay. Diane.
Hi. Thank you, Jimmy, because what you talk about, I find is something I reflect on a lot. Always the difference between practicing alone and then going out in the world and being just as reactive as I used to be or even more. And then I practice more at home and it seems to be a constant dance that's sometimes driving me crazy. But thank you for bringing the subject. My question is very simple. It's about what are table prostrations for a nundro?
It's where you're standing up and maybe you have a table or a kitchen counter.
Yeah.
And so when you prostrate and you go out with your arms, you know, and you put your chest down, it's on the top of the table so that you don't bend, you know, theoretically, depending on how tall you are, you don't bend your knees at all.
That could be an option.
If that's what makes the difference between you doing Nundro safely or not, that's an option.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Lilia.
Well, just a caveat. I didn't actually do what you described as half prostrations. I did tabletops, but I did them sitting. So I was sitting at a table and did this and then sort of lay myself out on the table from the waist up. So that was another version.
Better yet. Okay, last one, right?
To add to that one, I remember when I was doing my prostration nondro, I was told that you should not step over one day. So I did when I could. And I was working at the Olympic Park in Montreal from 8:15 in the morning to 11:30 at night, which were long stretch. So the only time I had to do prostration was being on my bike, going and returning home. So I would hold one part of the bike do my prostration, recite the text and do it. And I counted it as those days in which I had the only moment to do it. I was so stressed by missing one. That's a funny story. But I want to ask you, maybe eventually, not now because we may not have time, that you could come back and explain to everyone about the meaning of what is a skillful mean. I understand what a skillful mean is, but I think it's important that we know very well what we talk about when we talk about these non-dro practices. They're tools, and there's no magic in it. Or there's a kind of magic that we can understand, actually. That would be nice that you elaborate a little more on this.
Okay. Maybe next time, Ray.
Sure.
I don't want to keep people past the hour, so.
Take note.
Yeah. So as always, let's take a moment to imagine that if there was something helpful or wholesome, life-giving, sane, that we experienced this in this last hour, let's just multiply that because we can. Just multiply it and send out that goodness to everyone around the globe who needs some goodness so badly. And maybe in this next week. So we talked a lot about Nundro and all that. And for those of you who aren't doing Nundro, that's perfectly fine. And Nundro, again, is just a method. It's not a requirement. There are many other things we can do. So I didn't mean to leave you out. But as we go about our day in the next week or two, we can honor our tradition by just bringing to mind a quality of sort of mindfulness and care, a kind of light touch with our world, and carry with us just a simple intent that whatever we do, whoever we encounter, we leave the situation or we enter the situation and we leave the situation with a little heart, a little care, the aspiration to be kind of a influence for what is helpful and wholesome and good. This is at the very core of who we are as Dharma people, to be careful about what we do with our body, speech, and mind, and to incline it to what is good and what is helpful. Remember when the Buddha was asked, you know, who are you and what do you do? And he said, what do you teach? And he said, practice no harm, propagate virtue extensively, and thoroughly tame your mind. So within that, that's the entirety of our tradition. And so we can keep that in mind during the week to come. Okay, everybody. So let's thank you so much, and we'll see you again soon. And let's unmute and say goodbye.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Obrigada, team.
Obrigada a todos. Thank you. Bye-bye. Have a good day. Bonne journée, tout le monde.